They say, and I've said, that beer is liquid bread. Well, my guest today has figured out a way to eat your beer. This is an episode about asking, hey, what if? It's about daring to wonder and about entrepreneurship. You'll hear how my guest and his friend discovered how to eat their beer as well as the bread they made from the spent grains from that beer. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 199.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Culinary Libertarian, welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Hey, folks, I'm back at it. We took a week-long vacation to Yosemite and San Francisco. We got to see the sequoia groves before the big fire and didn't see any biological events in San Francisco. I'm okay with that. We did a lot of the touristy things, Alcatraz, sourdough bread at Boudin, the streetcars, a Giants game, dinner in Chinatown, and more. We took a lot of digital photos. If you had an adventure this summer, or are going to, get your favorite photos printed into a book to share and keep on your shelf. It's much easier than fumbling through your phone, and you can make copies for your companions. Check out the options for your memories from Bookamon with my link, culinarylibertarian.com/familybook. Dan Kurzrock is my guest today. Dan is the co-founder of Regrained, a company that started by drying and grinding the grains from beer making to then make more products. Dan has also built UpcycledFoods.com, which looks at other food ingredient ideas from overlooked sources. Hello, Dan. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Hello, Dan. Thanks for having another Dan on the show.
Indeed. And it might have happened once before, but nobody as important as you.
You say that to all your Dans, don't you?
I might. Every day when I look in the mirror, Stuart Smalley. Well, that's aging me. Never mind. That's a bad politics joke. So today we're going to talk about several things all wrapped up into one, and one of them is food waste and conservation. But before we get into that and the company you started, give us a bit of a background about you and how you sort of came into this.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. So yeah, my name's Dan Kurzrock. I am the founder and CEO of Upcycled Foods Incorporated, which is better known for our first brand, Regrained. I got into this, I kind of stumbled into the food industry, like I think a lot of us do. I was a college student many moons ago now, but fell in love with the hobby of making beer when I was still underage. And so every week we got to the point where we were brewing every week, and I loved the experience of crafting homebrew, but was just floored by how much grain was used in that process, and started asking some bigger questions about what other people do with this material, what we as civilization have done with it in the past, what we're doing commercially, with it today. And, as each question, the pursuit of that led to answers, got more and more energized around building a food business that could connect the dots in a new way between overlooked and undervalued sources of nutrition, flavor, functionality that are either created as a inadvertent co-product of another manufacturing process, like with beer production and this really nutritious grain, or also agricultural side streams are really interesting to us too. So crops like coffee and chocolate, have other materials that could be created so that we can build a a more circular food system, you know, do more with less. So I would say kind of came at this as a, I don't know if I would have identified as an entrepreneur, you know, at the time, but, you know, originally it was really just entrepreneurial, like recreational entrepreneurship is how I joke about it. Cause I was making beer and then I would sell bread made with the grains that were left over from that process and then use the money from that to buy more ingredients to brew more beer. And one thing, you know, led to another, and now we're doing a whole lot more. But that's how it all started. Went on to do a graduate program focused on sustainable business. So big believer in business as a force for good. You know, there's a lot of problems we're facing right now as a planet, and business as usual, you know, played a large role in creating some of them. And I, you know, really believe that the idea that a new, better model for business can play also, you know, an equally key role in, you know, addressing those problems. And yeah, just super passionate about what we do, and looking forward to sharing more with you here, Dan.
Me too. So you sent me a small box of your product. So homebrewers or people who are beer drinkers may sort of visualize at the bottom of, if you're a homebrewer, at the bottom of your carboy, whatever you're making, you've got this, well, it's kind of sludgy stuff. It's wet, heavy, goopy, very yeasty smelling spent grains. And I've used them before to make bread. The stuff you sent me had a fabulous beer aroma to it. Slightly smell of alcohol, but not being coarse at all. It was ground to a flour consistency. A really nice, almost hazelnut brown color. But it's just like, wow, this is impressive. So you've taken this stuff, probably invented some technology or repurposed something to dry it out, mill it into a usable product, and you suggested I make bread out of it. So I did. So at your suggestion.
Yeah, it would be helpful maybe for the listeners if I can kind of go through like that what that material, you know, is. Like the beer. Yes. A lot of people don't think of beer as food, you know, but beer is an agricultural product. And you know, it's so specifically in the beginning of the beer making process, brewers are they're kind of like making oatmeal. They take hot water and they mix it with the grains, and that's called the mash. So, what you were referring to as the carboy, you know, that comes later with fermentation, and there's some yeast that, you know, falls out of suspension there that, you know, is another byproduct from the brewing process. But in the very beginning on the brew day, when they're soaking these grains in hot water, they're basically extracting sugars from them. And so they, you know, they drain this this wet mash, you know, that again, it kind of looks like oatmeal, but it's barley based. And so what the brewers are left with is this liquid that goes on to become beer. That's called wort. They boil it, they add hops, they cool that down, they add yeast. The yeast has a nice party consuming the sugars, turning them into alcohol, multiplying, you know, until they basically run out of party supplies. And, you know, then you end up with beer. But like way back in the beginning of that process, that grain is still has all the fiber and protein, you know, that was in the barley, just less of the sugar. But to your point, it's soaking wet, you know, and so it's difficult to deal with. It spoils quickly traditionally. And so we actually, we worked with the USDA and we developed an optimized process for stabilizing it, drying it out, you know, and then through a mill, you know, milling, which is just typical like particle size reduction, right? Take it to a format that someone like you, you know, professional bakers and food product developers can take and use as a base material to make new products. Now, as you probably discovered, and I'd love to hear about your experience, it's not a flour. Like it looks like it's a flour-like consistency, but you know, when you're making breads, for example, flour of course contributes a lot to the gluten, structure and all the functional gluten from the grain, which barley has very little functional gluten to begin with. You know, ends up, you know, being extracted through that beer making process. So you've got this really flavorful, really nutritious ingredient. But you know, what did you make with it? How did you approach it? How did it come out?
Well, I knew I was up against time because we were leaving in a couple of days, so I didn't have the chance to really make a long sourdough. So my decision was to do a no knead bread. So mm-hmm. That's easy. You mix it, let it sit on the counter for 18 to 24 hours, put it in your hot Dutch oven, bake it, and you're done. So you get a sourdough-esque bread. You get a good aroma, a good sour flavor without having to take the time to do a proper sourdough. So at your suggestion, 15% of the super grains and an additional 15% of water. So I mixed everything, and at the additional 15% of water, that stuff is thirsty. So I was like, this, it didn't even resemble dough at that point. It was still shaggy. I was like, needs more water. So I ended up with an astonishing 37.5% increase in liquid. And it made what I expected, a very soft yet stable dough, which I expected to turn into something with lots of gas bubbles. And so I'm like, oh, this is perfect, because it looked exactly like all of the other no-knead breads I'd made. Left it on the counter. 18 hours later, put it out on the countertop, and something happened. And the significant something that happened was it let go of a lot of that water. Like, man, this is wet stuff. So any bakers who know what it means to form a really wet, like a really wet focaccia or ciabatta, you have to move your hands faster than the dough sticks. Now that sounds like, what are you talking about? It's weird. That doesn't make sense. Well, it's a baking thing. So I'm trying to get this thing shaped in any way I can to lift it up, turn it over, put it in my hot Dutch oven. Finally did, and it stuck. Boy, howdy did it stick. And I was like, man, oh man. So I was fighting with it to get it out. The flavor is fantastic. But I was really surprised. And so I have other plans to do. I have plans to do banana muffins. I want to try it in pancakes. I want to try it as the breading and say, like, now, because it has that nuttiness, I think it would be fantastic as the outer coating and say, like, a steak finger. Because it would be that would be a compliment. Chicken, it might work, but I don't think it's, I want more compatibility than contrast. So there's lots of applications still to try, but that at first is like, well, all right. So there's more bread ideas to play with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Great to hear that story. And it's you know, we always like seeing what people like you do with do with this ingredient, because it is it's new, you know. It doesn't perform like a conventional flour. It's not, we don't want to over prescribe exactly, you know, how to replicate, you know, some of the things that we've done, you know, commercially, because it's also just fascinating to see what, you know, talented people like yourself are able to come up with. Yeah, it is a very, it's a very thirsty material, even more so than a dark rye, you know, for other, like, you know, bakers that are out there. The flavors, as you noted, it pairs really well with sourdough. You know, but there's depending on what you're, you know, what you're making, it's an innovation process, right? You know, of trial and error. Commercially, you know, we've got a nice relationship with a company called Puratos that you may be familiar with. They have like the largest sourdough library in the world. That's one of the things that they're famous for.
Yes.
And you know, together, you know, we've been able to create some really incredible, kind of like more like retail ready, you know, type breads that bring our technologies together and help kind of soften the learning curve, you know, for commercial bakeries to, you know, to get into this. But when one of my favorite things personally is to hear what you know, folks like you that have culinary and, you know, baking, you know, backgrounds, you know, are inspired to do with it. Quick breads are a great idea with where to go next. You know, we've done some coatings and breadings on the bench too. You know, this stuff has this stuff has some great flavor, some great potential, and I'm excited to hear what you do with it next, Dan.
Well, I'm excited to share it with you, and I got to figure some of those things out. I want to ask you about, so there's the ingredient list shows up. It's you'll have to correct me if I forgot. It's rye, barley, and I think wheat. And yeah, there's a comment. Mm-hmm. There's a note on the invoice that this is that there's It doesn't say how much, but it does, it identifies it as not a gluten-free product. And so, and maybe this answer doesn't exist because from batch to batch, the ratios might change. Can you guesstimate what is the percentage of gluten, or is that just too hard to know?
We are in the process of identifying the right way to, you know, accurately test this ongoing. As it relates to, you know, the allergen, you know, gluten as an allergen, and of course, there's, depending on where you are, there's different regulations here, but here in the US, I believe it's like 20, under 20 parts per million. You know, barley is fairly low gluten to begin with. Wheat is obviously very high in gluten. This, our blend is mostly barley, and most of that gluten has been extracted by the beer brewing process. And as you saw, functionally, there's very little support you get from that gluten for the dough development. But no, we do not today, you know, try to, you know, kind of position this as something that gluten-free people that have a gluten-free allergen can, you know, can have just because that gluten's been reduced by the brewing process. You know, over time, you know, we'll have some more information about that, and you know, we'll of course be transparent about it. But yeah, this product does contain gluten. Because it's based in barley, which starts out with gluten.
Well, and my curiosity is because my wife has an autoimmune problem, Hashimoto's, and that's nothing horrible. It's not like a really bad celiac problem, which can be very, very serious very quickly. It does cause fatigue and some other things, and so we try to avoid it. So I was just there's lots of ways. Some days she can tolerate a little bit. Some days I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. So it's more of a curiosity than actual fact finding.
And we'd love to hear, you know, if she's willing to try the product to see how it affects her compared to other, other experiences in the past. Anecdotally, it's been shared with us that people that have gluten intolerances, but not gluten allergens because of the high fiber content, especially if it's in an application that's using sourdough, you know, it tends to, support healthy digestion more so than a conventional, wheat flour. And so we'd love to hear where that, if you have any insight there, over time, it's always nice to get those, get that feedback from folks.
So in addition to selling the bulk, you call it super grains, you have pushed into developing some products and product kits. So, and I saw, I think it was a TED talk you gave back, 2016 maybe? You and your co-founder eating this giant slab of granola. You're still making granola bars, and what else have you gone into using these super grains?
Yeah, so I mean, when we came up with the concept, you know, one of the first questions was, "Wow, well, what can we use this? You know, what can this be used for?" We knew that we wanted to develop, and this is, even back from the beginning, and we knew that we wanted to develop ingredient solutions. You know, work with companies that are already making food products, and then help them create products that use these upcycled grains. Because those, you know, if you think about it from a mission standpoint, those companies already have distribution. They're already really, you know, good at, their core product lines. And then if they can introduce these more sustainable supply chains in there, we can, you know, expand our impact that way. And so we have explored a lot of different uses for the grain. The first thing that we ever did was make granola after the bars. And then after the bread, and then we did make bars, and we actually have launched a couple, as you know, and if you go to regrain.com, you could find some of the consumer products that we have now. We've rotated some new ones in and some old ones out. And for us, it's a way to showcase the kind of proof of concept for different products. So we did these snack bars. We did like a savory chip, you know, like a puffed chip product. And then more recently, we've done some baking mixes. So people, you know, like brownie mix, pizza crust, banana bread, carrot cake, where people can skip the recipe development part of the process and just see how this tastes in application. And then for us, what's nice is it's not just a good way to spread the word about upcycled foods and about, about our super grains, but also can show different avenues of applications for our business to business customers, which is, you know, where we really spend most of our time is working with other businesses to create products to then bring to market under their own brand.
Are you getting the grains from a single brewery, or how are you sourcing the grains?
Yeah, so we have a roster of breweries that we work with. Kind of the high level that I'll share is that we focus on breweries that are making core beers, flagship beers that are, you know, canned or bottled and in distribution, because from there, and that means they're making the same recipes in the same way. So we can have consistency in terms of input. There's about 1 pound of grain used for every 6-pack of beer. So even a single brewery in a single year generates a lot of potential supply for us. Then longer term, we have this the technology that we talked about a little earlier that stabilizes the material, dries it out. And our vision for that is actually to build multiple of these machines and actually deploy them on site, you know, co-located with the point of production, so that, again, not just the consistent inputs as we talked about there, but then there's also not a transportation factor of water involved, which is required if you're processing offsite. That's a little bit as to like how we work with breweries to produce consistent product.
Are you familiar with I'm sure you are familiar with the look of and the feel of bulgur wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried turning these dry grains into something like bulgur? Is there a market, do you think, for a coarser version of these grains?
We are certainly looking at applications where the particle size, has different, coarsenesses. You know, for certain applications, a coarser texture can be better. When we were talking about like how to launch an ingredient, we wanted to launch in a format that has the most versatility, which is, you know, the product that you had. But we're always looking at, you know, what people want this format of the product to be it a different grind or even another value added application. So we actually just launched a protein crisp, for example, that is like a puffed rice that is a little textured piece that has the super grain in it. And so for companies that are used to working with these crisps, they can use a regrain crisp, you know, as an ingredient too. So it's kind of like a value added product as an ingredient. Now, what I'll say about the coarser texture, this material has about 40% fiber by weight. So it's got, and fiber tends to be easier to work with, the finer the particle size. But as we keep the ideas coming, we'd love to hear what folks might be interested in seeing as far as a starting
just
point.
Visualizing a toothsomeness, if I get this bread right, or even in a sandwich loaf, I like seeing and feeling and tasting the big pieces of grains in a bread because it's attractive, gives mm-hmm. you a little bit of, you know, texture change. So it's just kind of a fun thing and you get a little flavor burst there. So seemed like a possibility. I don't know if it's actually possible, but it seemed like a good idea. Your TED Talk had a lot of passion about, of course, the business, which that's a good thing. But it seems like there's at least two other aspects. I'm not going to say exactly to your mission, because I think you have a mission statement, but at least goal-oriented ideas. One is learning how to see food ingredients that aren't necessarily, see food waste in less than obvious ways. So the spent grain is certainly something that looked like it's garbage, but wait a minute, there's things to do here. Old bananas are turned into banana bread. I'm not entirely sure what you do with old wrinkly mangoes, but there's ways to start challenging, even for people at home, What do I have in my fridge that's going bad? How can I, instead of throwing this in the garbage can and then, one, first of all, wasting cash, and then adding problems to landfills or whatever, there's a way to rethink how we view less than fresh food. But also, I think one of your drives is to actuate people who might be armchair entrepreneurs to get out of the armchair. If you've got an idea, I think you said the hardest step is to go from zero to one. Get up, pursue your idea.
Absolutely. You know, and for us, that was, we started with an idea, and there's, just had to take the first step. You know, so the first thing we ever did was we just started making product and seeing if we could sell it and seeing what people thought about it. You know, and for us, you know, tying back to the mission, you know, there's a tremendous amount of food waste that we generate as you know, not just as a country, but as a, you know, as a planet. And, you know, on a individual scale, you think about, you know, as a chef, you know, running maybe a restaurant kitchen, you know, it's intuitive to reduce waste. You know, and we're trying to take that that mentality of nose to tail, you know, root to stem cooking traditions, but I don't know, from an industrial perspective, looking at where there's not you know, opportunity being fully captured. You know, and this again, it's not, you know, we call it upcycled foods, and it's got a kind of innovation bend to it. You know, we're considered to be an innovative food, you know, food company, which we certainly appreciate the accolades for that. But we feel like it's common sense. You know, you look at products like whey protein, which is created from, of course, the dairy, you know, the dairy industry, and as a side stream from cheese production. And so we've, you know, found that the brewery grains are mostly going to animal feed, you know, which is way better than landfill, but is still a lower use than feeding people. And, you know, I've sought to close the loop on that. But in that process, we've identified that there's actually other supply chains like brewer's grains that are, you know, being left off the table. And so we're looking at those and, you know, creating ingredient solutions from these other inputs, things like the, you know, leftovers of juice making processes or plant-based milks or, you know, as I was mentioning at the top of the show, products like, you know, coffee. When coffee is harvested, you know, how there's an opportunity to use not just the bean, but also the fruit and the leaf of that plant. And yeah, you got to go from zero to one on, you know, on many of these things. And entrepreneurs, whether or not their idea is about food waste or something else that's, you know, that's better for the world. I mean, if you think of it, like innovation is about putting creativity in action, right? So it's like you got to take that action. So we've always been very, you know, oriented towards just, you know, pursuing in the real world. You know, these ideas, and we hope that and we know we're not alone, and we're inspired by many that came before us, and we hope that there's many rising entrepreneurs that are going to take the same tact, particularly if they're focused on bettering the world. You know, those are the ideas we need more of.
I think one of the things, and we sort of talked about it, but I think it's, We certainly glossed right over it, and I just sort of was thinking about this. And so your comment about following in the stead of others, and in your TED talk, you mentioned that most home brewers, well, that may not be true. Some home brewers may use their spent grains. Maybe they have chickens. Maybe it's spectacular chicken feed. Maybe they do make bread. Maybe they find a way because they recognize there's, and if nothing else, there's a cash investment here. How can I stretch my cash the most? Which is a fine idea. Frugality is nothing wrong with that. But one of the things that I think is impressive here, and maybe that's true for lots of food businesses, is you're already using lots of established infrastructure. Not building anything new necessarily. You're using what's already there, introducing this new idea. So I think that as innovation goes, the innovation of using what exists seems like it's a really good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you think about something just like even just the water footprint aspect of food production. In beer making, about 90% of the water footprint is in the agricultural supply chain for the grain. You would think, when you're making beer, you're using water in the brewing process, and that is some of the water footprint. But most of it is actually in the production of the barley and the malt. And roughly speaking, it comes to, if we say it's about a pound of grain, of malt for every 6-pack of beer, that pound of malt takes somewhere between like 300 and 350 gallons of water to produce. And so, of course, being from the wildfire state, in Northern California, we're very set in a just prolonged, people think of drought as this like, oh, it's a drought, it's going to pass. It's like, no, this is normal now. This is what we're living with. We're very sensitive to water as a resource out here. And so just this idea of, okay, all this water, all this resources have gone into producing this product, like why not, to your point, make two products where you previously, could have one. So kind of building off that, infrastructure as you put it. And then, we had to develop a way to actually make that practical, as a new product. But it's about doing more with less, right? And it's about, thinking, frankly, more like nature. In nature, there is no waste. There's a great field called biomimicry that if people want to, if you're inspired by kind of sustainability, the models and thinking, definitely check it out. Or there's a great TED talk by Janine Benyus, about biomimicry. In nature, there is no waste. Death begets new life, right? And you look at the forest and if you're especially up in the Northwest, where you are, you can see that there's old fallen trees that have become nurse logs, fostering new life. And so our whole thing is like, hey, let's take this this very we feel is like common sense, approach, this value set of doing more with less, and let's find where it's not being applied in our food system, and try to play a role commercially as a solution for kind of connecting those dots in a new way, if you will.
I think it's a good idea. I'm going to go back to the coffee bean leaf because I don't think I know anything about this. So tell me, so I understand the coffee cherry, it's not a cherry actually, but usually the red fruit's discarded and the cherry pits, if you will, are saved and ground into coffee. What does one do with coffee bean leaves?
Yeah, no, great question. And coffee cherry, by the way, is also now available as it's also known as cascara, and that's something that you're starting to see beverage products produced with. There's a company up in Seattle called the Coffee Cherry Company that's doing some really interesting stuff with coffee cherry. The leaf is created is part of the tree, of course, right? One thing a lot of people don't realize about coffee, just circling back to the bean itself, is that harvest is about 3 months of the year. So it's not a crop that is harvested, harvested year round. Now, throughout the care, as coffee growers are caring for the trees, and there's pruning that happens, and you can also strategically prune to get the leaves from that plant, which actually have caffeine in them, just like coffee does, low levels, more like a tea, and then through tea processing, pruning these trees and creating dehydrated leaves. This as another beverage, not only is a source of caffeine, but there's also a huge amount of antioxidants, more antioxidants than green tea. And it's got some great flavor. It's very low in tannins, pretty mild, a little bit. It's kind of reminiscent if you've ever traveled to South America and had coca tea, like in Peru. It's kind of a little bit similar in flavor profile to that. And we think it's a really interesting product, So there's a great brand up in the Northwest in BC, called Wyze, Wyze Tea, WYZE, and they've developed a line of canned, you know, teas, and they also sell some loose leaf tea. And so we loved what they're doing. We decided to partner up and help find some new, you know, some new opportunities to use the coffee leaf in more applications beyond, you know, beyond their brand. And it's, to your point, you've never heard of coffee leaf tea, right? It's not something that is commonly known.
But it also sounds like it's an opportunity for the coffee growers to earn a little extra income.
Yeah, exactly. It's not for year round revenue. You know, so it's got this social impact as well. You know, and the supplier that you know that we've partnered with, you know, they're totally vertically integrated too. So this is not common practice today to create this this co-product from the coffee harvest. But that's you know, that's part of what innovation is all about, right? Showing what we've been overlooking. And there's, like I was saying, there's a history of human consumption of this material at the country of origin. And there's a lot of other examples of supply chains like that, you know, with cacao, you know, the bean goes on to become chocolate. There's the fruit from the cacao. That's a really interesting product. Or if you think of, a lot of people are used to eating cashews. I don't know how many people though have actually seen what a cashew looks like.
They're stunning,
and it's the cashew, you know, nut as we think of it is actually like the tip at the end of what is basically like a crab apple. You know, it's like it looks like a small apple. Most of the mass of the coffee of the cashew fruit is this fruit, not the nut. It's not like it's a pit. You know, it's actually like there's this fruit and then the cashews at the end of it. I highly encourage people to go look at what cashew fruit, you know, is. And there's, again, a history of human consumption at the places where cashew is harvested of this fruit, but not at a mass scale. Most of the time it's discarded because there's not an established market for it. And so we're very inspired by discoveries, you know, of these, you know, just how much potential, you know, there is that already exists in our food system that we just need to tap into with a little bit of creativity and technology in some cases.
You know, I've seen pictures and I've seen short videos of people harvesting these giant apples to get this little teeny nut. And it's possible I had the thought that why don't they use the rest of it? And the first conclusion you come to, it seems perfectly reasonable. If there was something to do with it, somebody would have done something with it. So it's, and I don't know anything about that. I've never been to Brazil. I don't harvest cashews. I don't know the first thing about what is the problem with the tree. I know that mangoes in the poison ivy family. So if you've got problems with poison ivy, you probably shouldn't be picking mangoes because that's not going to be good for you. So maybe there's, I don't know. But yeah, it's just well, one of those.
Is a very common logical fallacy, honestly, of that. You know, it's called an appeal to tradition. It's like, oh, just because things are the way that they are, because that's the way that they've always been, you know, therefore all better ideas have already been thought of and ruled out, you know, which is of course not the case when you like actually, you know, think about that a little, you know, a little deeper, but, you know, and that's exactly what we're, the type of thinking we're looking to disrupt with, you know, what we're doing as Upcycled Foods Incorporated, you know, saying, asking those deeper level questions of, hey, we've been overlooking this. Why? What are the assumptions that went into that? And, you know, what, you know, are we missing an opportunity for great flavor, great nutrition, great, you know, functionality, or ideally all, you know, all three plus, you know, sustainability. And so, yeah, I mean, I think your little anecdote about, seeing like the cashew being harvested is very common. You know, you see something like that and you're like, oh, so, I mean, if this was a good idea, someone would have figured it out already.
Right. I mean, it seems like a reasonable conclusion.
Right.
Even if it's flawed, it just seems, you know, you made the comment that in the restaurants, because restaurant margins are thin anyway, even in the best of restaurants, the thing to do is utilize as much of the ingredient as you can. So when you see really attractive peeled asparagus on the plate, you probably don't think, what happened to the peel? Well, it didn't go in the garbage can. If the chef knows what he's doing, he turns it into soup. and got $5 a bowl for what would have been garbage. So I mentioned mangoes earlier. There is, as far as I know, nothing to do with mango skins, partly because of that poison ivy issue, but mango pits. Mm-hmm. If you have enough mango pits, steep them in cream, let that cool, strain it out, and then turn that into creme anglaise for an ice cream. Now, that's the thing. Now, it takes more inputs, but you're getting spectacular mango flavor out of what's left there because you can't get all the mango stuff off. It gets fibery, and nobody wants to chew the fibers, and it gets yuck, but you can get the flavor out of there for the mango ice cream. It's like, oh my gosh, this is so good. So there's ways to do that.
Absolutely. And like avocado pit is another really, you know, interesting.
Tell me about avocado pit. What do I do with that?
Yeah. So you can, so check out, if you want to see a commercial example, there's a company called Reveal Tea, and they are, their first product line is a beverage made from avocado pits. I think there's a, I'm not super fluent in all the nutritional benefits. I believe there is an antioxidant, you know, benefit there, as well as some nice flavor. The company was launched by a culinary, food science student who was just floored by how many avocado pits there were commercially when guacamole is produced. And started asking, similar to what we did with the brewer's grain, like, you know, what are we missing here? You know, and so, and I don't know about mango skins specifically, but the skins of other fruits and vegetables, you know, also represent opportunities. If with fruit, you know, there's a lot of nutritional value that's still in the peel. There's a dried fruit company called Rind Snacks that makes skin-on dried fruit. I've actually always preferred kiwis with the skin on. I'm weird like that.
The fuzz bothers me. It just.
Yeah. But what about, you know, you don't think of like eating orange peels, but you know, if you try, try these rind snacks, they've got quite a big following and growing. And it's cause, they're not just cause they have a great story, but you know, great flavor. And there's a lot of nutritional benefit with the peels, but also there's historical examples similar to what I was sharing with whey and dairy processing. You know, with citrus peels are, of course, industrially off processed into pectin, you know, which is a standard, you know, ingredient for, you know, jams.
All kinds of things.
All kinds of things. And so, you know, what I'm saying is that we're in these different areas, we've kind of stumbled into putting these materials to better use, but without really, you know, no one's really mapped out what all of them are and which ones we maybe haven't explored yet. And that's one of the things that we're doing as a business, is kind of acting as a discovery engine for what else is out there. And I love this idea for, you know, a culinary perspective of what you shared with the mango pits. And, you know, you can actually commercially get mango pits as a powder.
Interesting. You know,
there's a lot that can be done.
Well, I know from a confectioner's standpoint, the orange peel is just, you know, you boil it and drain it a couple of times, and it's candied orange peel. I mean, it's delicious. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
But there's people who don't want to do that, and maybe there's more to it than is the obvious. Do you have any products you can tell us about that are coming out or that you're experimenting with and seeing what's happening?
Yeah, we have a bread that's going to be launched by a national retailer by the end of the year that we're really excited about. We also we had a bread launch last month. It was a baguette with a group called Hungry Harvest. They're an online grocer. The big news though for this month is this protein crisp. You know, it's less of a culinary use and more of a for CPG companies, which is a really nice functional ingredient that's made with the vegan. Sounds like Fido wants some as well.
No, someone's coming home.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, there's some products that we're working on in the pet industry, in addition to human food products. A lot, we're doing a lot in snack. I'd mentioned earlier, breaders and coaters for different proteins. So yeah, we've got close to like 150 different projects that we're
Really?
actively working on right now that should come online in the next 2 years. But these things
That's impressive.
take time.
Very good. Well, that's exciting. I was thinking also one of the I do sometimes make my own dog treats. And normally I would use spelt flour, but I'm gonna try it with the super grains and see what I end up with because it sounds like a good idea. And
Yeah, we've actually got
Douglas.
one of our nonprofit partners down here in Northern California. They're called Food Shift. They do some great like food recovery, and they have some great like jobs, training programs, and just an amazing organization. They're called Food Shift. They're coming out with they're an actual packaged pet treat product that's 100% upcycled. So it's using our brewer's grain in the base of the dough, but also they have I think it was like chicken fat. They have a it's like byproducts from their catering business, that they're able to put into this too,
It's a good
which
idea.
it was just smart, and it'll help fund what they're doing as a nonprofit too. So that's exciting. But we've got and yeah, pet treats is something that you can find online actually a number of examples of home brewers that have done that before. There's a show actually on Netflix a couple of years ago called Easy. It was based in Chicago, and it was a what they call it called mumblecore. As a, like it looked like you're watching a documentary almost, but it was a it's just it was a good it was a good show. And on that show, there are these two brothers homebrew, and their wives make dog treats with their grain. So that's a pretty tried and true application. The other one I didn't mention this, but like pastas is another good use for this material. Works really well in noodles, and we've done some Italian pastas in the past already, and we're working on some more Asian style noodles. And yeah, I mean, if you can name it, we're probably regraining it.
Fantastic. That's awesome. Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
All right, I want to shift a little bit into, well, shift a lot bit into a different part of the show here. This is a short answer part, not necessarily a regrained thing, but it's certainly in the culinary aspect. Of the five flavors, bitter, sweet, sour, salty, or umami, which one is your favorite?
I like all of them. Probably like salty or umami for me. I would say I'm more of a savory guy.
What's your favorite food?
Oh my God. That's why my wife would be able to answer that in a second. She would say cheese. Cheese and potatoes and then ice cream. I'm just gonna go with, I'm kind of cheating here, but I'm just gonna go with burritos.
What's your least favorite food?
My least favorite food would, God, I love so many different kinds of food. I don't really, I'm not very into like edible flowers and that sort of stuff. Like I've always had things with like I think lavender's pretty to look at, but like I don't really like eating it. But that's just me. I know a lot of people like that.
What sound do you love?
Music, heavier the better.
What sound do you hate?
Don't know, probably like phone notifications.
What gets you excited?
The outdoors. skiing, biking, etc.
What turns you off?
Waste.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Probably like a hamburger type stuff, like really good animal based meat burgers. I was traveling this week and had this burger where the bun was grilled cheeses, bacon grilled cheese burger between it, and an egg on it. And I was like, man, this is like the most indulgent thing I've eaten in a long time. And I was pretty happy.
It's like a keto burger. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, I call it a keto burger.
How can people follow you?
We're easy to find. So just at Regrained on the social medias is the best way to, follow what Regrained is doing. Our business to business, more ingredient oriented presence is at upcycledfoods.com. So our upcycledfoods.com website has our B2B information. I'm on LinkedIn. My name's Dan Kurzrock. Love hearing from folks.
Okay. And I will put the Regrained and UpcycledFoods.com links on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/199. It looks like we have a couple more minutes. Can you hang out? I'm going to do, this is a part for the Patreon supporters, and it's called Chef's Table.
Okay.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add links to both Upcycled Foods and Regrained to the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/199. It's good to be back. Thanks for staying with me. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my patrons at Patreon. The Chef's Table portion of this episode is up on the members section of Patreon, and you can join the rest of the patrons at culinarylibertarian.com/support. Next week starts the 200s. That's exciting. I have a good show planned for 200 and some very good guests scheduled for the next several episodes. I'm excited about it, and I think you'll like it. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.